I'm very happy for you all to meet Jeremy Donovan. He is the co-author of our new book, Predictable Prospecting, that's coming out in August 2016. And Jeremy is a gem. He's one of those guys who is always optimistic, always willing to try something new, always ready to receive instruction and put it into execution. He's like the perfect client. He wants you and your team to be happy while doubling sales. He helps companies achieve both at the same time. He started out as an electrical engineer, but he quickly transitioned into roles like his current role as the head of sales strategy at Gerson Lehman Group, GLG. He's also a very accomplished author and has written a number of different books, some under pseudonyms, so you have to kind of look for them. One of my favorite was Strategic Storytelling, which got me along the framework that I developed for my clients called Compel with Content, which teaches how to write emails that are actionable in nature and get people to move and advance those opportunities. His goal, though, is to make prospecting more personal and effective to the teams he works with while also making their job easier. So he's a master at leveraging people, process, and technology in order to achieve that end goal of predictable revenue that's consistent so that if you want to scale your organization, you can do so. In this podcast, Jeremy reveals tips on rolling out a new policy smoothly, how to write effective emails that actually get responses, common issues and requests among sales teams, and finally, his biggest tip ever to increase your prospecting. So welcome, everybody. Today I'm here with Jeremy Donovan. Jeremy and I go back not very long, but we've been working together on a project called Predictable Prospecting. And I've asked him to come on the show today because I really would like you all to hear his path and the way he views the outreach engine that we know and love. And especially when it comes to business and higher end, more complex sales. So I've asked him to join us today, and we're going to start by Jeremy giving us a background of how you progressed to where you are now and what actually you're in charge of. And then we'll talk a little bit about the types of programs that you've implemented and what you're finding as a success and what's failing and how you go about testing and all that good stuff.
Sure. Thanks. And thanks for having me on the podcast. I imagine I have one of the more non-traditional backgrounds of the sales and sales operations leaders that you've talked to. I actually started my career with a dream that I would be an engineer for the rest of my life, an electrical engineer, actually. And I pursued the dream for all of a year and a half before I became an analyst working for a information technology research company called Gartner. And then, you know, as engineering led to business, I moved into different roles in product development and product strategy and ultimately into corporate marketing and then over into sales leadership roles and sales operations roles. So now many, many moons removed from being a semiconductor engineer, I'm the head of sales strategy at a decent-sized company, although private, called Gerson Lehman Group, GLG, and we help connect business professionals with experts that give them guidance on strategies and decisions that they need to make. So big change for me, but I think part of what's in there is both of the fields that I've touched on recently, marketing as well as sales operations, are fields that have become increasingly technical and increasingly scientific as years have progressed. So I think that's why I find myself here, and that's why I find myself intellectually, you know, stimulated and challenged to do interesting work in the field.
So let's go into those challenges. As a sales strategist, what is a day in the life of Jeremy?
Lots of different pieces. I mean, if you think about sales strategy or sales operations, there's lots of elements to it. I mean, obviously one is processes that improve sales productivity. Then there's analytics, there's compensation and territory and, you know, on and on and on. So there's lots and lots of different pieces. For the last couple of months, I've been very heavily focused on implementing more robust outbound prospecting programs. And I think overall, just trying to improve sales productivity. In fact, I'm very proud of this, but my CEO called me into his office a few weeks ago and handed me a new badge, and it looked the same on the front as, and I was wondering why he handed it to me, and he said, "Take a look at the back." And the back, he had written my goals for the year, which amount to double the sales productivity of the organization while making the sales business development person much, much happier. So it's both a quantitative goal as well as something that's a bit more qualitative, although we do measure happiness of our employees. So I guess they're both measurable.
And so for the doubling sales growth, obviously you have a great background in how to do that with sales process. What are the types of things that you've started to implement or have in place now with that trajectory of doubling the sales growth?
Yeah, I think there's two things. I mean, one obviously is the more sales capacity you have, the more sales professionals you have, assuming you've got a good product and assuming the product is resonating in the market, the faster you're going to grow. So that's definitely one lever that I always pull. It's a lever that, you know, I learned when I was at Gartner, even though I was not directly involved in the beginning of it. Gartner grew its sales capacity from 2004, I think it was in the maybe 650 professionals, to well over 2,000 when I left a couple of years ago. You know, with the leadership of a great CEO and the leadership of a great head of sales. And you know, I've done the same thing, tried to replicate what they've done as I've moved from company to company. So that's one piece of it. And then the other piece, I think, is all about process and discipline. You know, if you walk into most B2B sales organizations, unless they've had a really rich sales culture, very process-centric culture, they tend to be a group of, you know, incredibly talented, highly entrepreneurial salespeople who I've found are actually hungry for a little bit more process and discipline, you know, not to be told what to do every day, obviously, and every hour of every day, but tricks and techniques that help them become more productive. And I think, you know, the stuff that you and I have been talking about for the past year and a half that we've known each other has really been instrumental to the success of the organizations that I've worked in.
So it's interesting. I had a conversation with a colleague this morning about that very topic of, you know, very seasoned sales professionals. They like their own rhythms. They don't necessarily want to conform to, you know, a process. But it's interesting, though, because once you start putting a process in and they see the habitual success because you're consistent and you're constantly improving, which I know you're a big fan of, that eventually they might acquiesce to having some of their accounts go through the engine. And so you're validating that by saying that you think the reps are really looking for some process, maybe not, like you said, not taking over their entire workflow. But have you discovered that in your current job that you're able to convince more people that it's not a curse to have a process in place?
Yes, definitely. And I think you got at something that's really fundamental, that so much of trying to improve sales productivity in any organization is all about change management. Mm-hmm. And it's the exact same change management that's around any initiative, any strategy initiative, whether it's in sales or elsewhere. And you know, there's a number of techniques I learned from a series of great bosses that I had at Gartner. Most of them, in fact, almost all of them, ex-McKinsey people. And you know, the what does not work is to come in with a radical new process and just ask everybody or expect everybody to march in line with that. That's bound to fail. And that's bound to lead to a very short tenure as a sales leader. The much, much better way is a kind of technique, I guess, that I learned, or an approach that I learned from one of my bosses. And he used to call it stacking the deck. And the way to stack the deck is, let's say you have a great new idea, process, or program, or whatever it happens to be. Go stack the deck by finding your best sales person or sales team on a very small scale. I mean, we're talking maybe one to a maximum of like one team of a sales manager and their whatever 6 to 8, which is the average salespeople. But take your very, very best team or your very, very best salesperson and work closely with them in order to to test out the process. And, you know, I think you and I share a philosophy, which is there's no right answer, right, for every situation. No one size fits all, I should say, answer for every situation, that every single company, even if they're the same in the same geography, the same size, in the same industry, every single company has some variation in what's going to work for them as a function of who their customers are, as a function of what their culture is like. So if I step into a new organization, I mean, a big part of my partnering with a successful salesperson or sales team is they have the rhythm of the organization, and they have a gut sense for what's going to work and what's not going to work. So, I mean, that partnership I've always found is incredibly instrumental. And so, you know, my approach coming in to the company I'm working for now is partnered with a great sales team, prove success at that scale, added another couple of teams, and then, you know, now deploying more broadly across the organization. And it's not like that takes forever. That's been about a 4-month or so process. But you have to make sure that you rack up those quick wins, and you really nurture those allies along the way, because those successful people are much more are a big part of convincing others. And I'll just add one last thing, which is I very, very much view myself as a service professional more than anything else, which is I am there in the service of salespeople to help them become more productive. And if the things I'm doing don't make their lives better, easier, then I'm doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that a 4-month process. Now, you have obviously extensive background in spotting even though everyone is unique, spotting those few 80-20 type things that you can start implementing right away. How long does it typically take you when you go into an organization that, you know, you're just starting out to assess the landscape and then put together a plan on average?
Yeah, I've gotten faster, and I think it's part of its experience, but I think part of it is the expectations of the, you know, the situations I step into. It used to be that new leaders had a, you know, they used to say have a 90-day plan, right? Or your first 100 days, whatever it happened to be. I think the 90-day and the 100-day plan is it's worthwhile to have one, but my feeling is I've got 30 days to try to figure things out. So when I step into a new role, you know, as I progressed through Gartner, where I used to work, I moved roles. In my 16 years there, I moved roles every couple years, sometimes as short as, you know, a year to 18 months. So my process was basically, you know, I step into the new job. In the first 30 days, I'm in listening mode, asking and listening mode. And I go and I figure out, you know, who the people with the knowledge inside the organization are, and I interview them when I say interview, it's really having conversations with them in a very open-ended way to understand both what's working and what's not working, what's been tried before, so that I don't, you know, repeat the failures of the past. And then I think very, very importantly, in fact, critically, I spend a significant amount of time in that first 30 days also talking to customers and prospects. So that's something that, you know, I did when I came into this organization. Did the interviews or discussions with our internal folks, and then spent a lot of time doing interviews with customers and prospects, and even fielded a couple of. I'm a big fan of just qualitative interviews, but every once in a while I'll do a quantitative survey. I think so many people make the mistake of jumping into a quantitative survey too early, but once I had a good sense qualitatively of what was going on, in order to justify certain decisions, I needed to do some survey work as well. I think that short answer to your question is really, I think you got 30 days to build a plan and then start executing to rack up some quick wins.
And so let's pretend that you've got the 30-day under your belt. At the same time you're interviewing, and I think that's a great idea to get that holistic view. What I like to do is also, if the company is large enough, we interview the product management team, customer service, people who touch the customer, and also people who are involved with prospects of any shape or form. And if we can get to the actual prospect like you did, that's great, and the clients as well. When you take that information, you have now a process in mind. What's the next step that you'll take? Because are tools involved? Do you have to go down that path at all? Or are you just, whatever you get, you can work with?
Sometimes tools are involved. I mean, I definitely think of any change, any initiative in the very classic framework way of people, process, and technology. So, you know, we talked a lot about people so far, the way that our what's been done in the past and by whom, and the prospects and customers, and the process piece we touched on. So technology wise, yeah, I think technology is important. I was reading something recently. I'm trying to remember which book. It might have even been Trish Bertuzzi's outstanding sales development playbook that just came out. And, it was basically talking about the fact that good tools are ones that actually make salespeople more productive. It sounds so basic, but there's just so much out there right now. I mean, I'm getting called multiple times a week, sometimes every day, or sent an email by somebody who's selling some new technology that supposedly will increase the productivity of the sales force. And, you know, maybe some of them will, most of them won't. And so the key is to find the tools that you work with that you find effective. You know, for me, I do find most salespeople grumble about Salesforce, but I find Salesforce to be quite effective. And I've seen Salesforce, I've seen Oracle, Siebel. Thus far for me, Salesforce is a much, much easier tool. Mm-hmm. I think it's the right thing for a mid to large size company. If you're a smaller company, there are plenty of other great CRMs out there like Zoho and Infusionsoft and things like that. So I think CRM is important. And then the other thing I found incredibly important, especially in the context of outbound prospecting, it used to be called SalesLoft Cadence, and now it's just called SalesLoft, but it's an outbound workflow management tool for salespeople to use that just helps them keep track of their activity. I mean, it's pretty widely reported. I think InsideSales.com has some great stats on this, but it's pretty widely reported that most salespeople give up after one or two touches. And, you know, if you just have one or two touches, the odds that you're going to actually get any kind of connection with a prospect are close to zero. If you have a 20% connect rate on a dial to reach a person, you got to call five times to get through, on average, to get through one time to them. So I try to build cadences that have at least five calls in them. And then most of the cadences I build tend to have two or three maximum emails. I just don't want people to feel spammed. But a tool like SalesLoft, and there's other ones out on the market that do similar things, just helps sales professionals to be consistent in their outreach without having to track it on paper or in Excel spreadsheets or whatever. They just, you know, they get to put their brains into developing real content, account-based or contact-based marketing, if you will, to reach out to individuals rather than having to spend their time managing too much of the process.
Let's talk a little bit about the cadences. You mentioned that you're blending the telephone in with email. What have your discoveries been in terms of emails? There's a lot of discussion around batch email where you're essentially taking data from a database, you're not personalizing those emails and you're sending them out to prospects versus a highly personalized email where it's almost a one-off. And then there's something in the middle where you are creating a template, but you're still doing research, you're still trying to figure out something of value for that particular person with whom you're going to be corresponding. But you do have a template that allows you to make sure you're covering all the points of the conversation to allow the prospect to say, you know what, this is something that might be interesting for me. I think, you know, it's worthy of having a conversation. Where are you along that spectrum now?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a spectrum, right? I mean, I think there is the generic, I'll call it sort of mass personalized email, and maybe you get dear first name or whatever, where the computer does all the work effectively.
Yeah.
And then there's the other end of the spectrum, which is every email handcrafted, every word of every email. I'm kind of in the middle, but definitely have a bias towards personalization. I mean, I just think of all the emails that I get, and the ones that look like spam, you know, it looked like spam, and the ones where it looks like the individual took, you know, even a few minutes to figure out who I am, are much, much more likely to get a response. You know, especially if they make reference to some shared connection we have, whether it's a hobby, I mean, even if it's a hobby, but certainly if it's a professional connection, or someone who's researched my company and knows what I'm doing. I mean, I have an extremely detailed, I should say, LinkedIn profile. So there's almost no excuse for someone to not be able to reference something in my profile when they reach out to me. So, you know, my middle ground is basically everyone, you know, I like to start out with a template, and the template has the critical language and the critical objective that's in there. But I encourage the sales professionals that I support, that I work with, to highly customize it. I mean, if it means that they need to blow the whole thing away, so be it. What they tend to do is they tend to put some, you know, very personalized text, at least at the top of the email, which I think is important. Mm-hmm. And then I actually think it's a nice touch to put personalized text at the bottom too, because so that you showed them that you knew them multiple times. And I think once at the beginning, once at the end is great. But even if it's just once at the beginning, I think that, you know, it's pretty effective. In fact, just today, about 20 minutes before our call, I got an email from one of our sales reps who we just on Friday, a couple days ago, you know, enabled with this outbound prospecting system, and he got a meeting via email. And I was reading through the email that he used, and he used most of our template that we had set him up with, but he added, you know, that little personal touch just at the beginning, and that was enough to get him, you know, to get him a meeting.
But there also is a lot that goes into the template piece that I don't want our listeners to think, oh, you know, we can just put something out there and then have them customize. Because in the body of the email, still, if people do not know you, there still has to be some reason why they're going to have a meeting. So obviously you set your folks up with some deep benefit statements or some reason for them to want to engage.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different formats, and one way I like to think about it, particularly because, you know, we sell into the B2B space, and we're usually selling to a VP or a director in particular functions, and we sell an information service, I think is the best way to describe it, a subscription-based information service, and you know, in those particular situations, you're often have one of two main types of templates and that can hook people. The first one is if you're selling into an organization that you're already doing business with, maybe you have a relationship with one person or two or five or 10, whatever, and you want to develop a relationship with a new person, it's incredibly powerful to just say, hey, look, you know, we're working with Jane over in XYZ division. I'd love to spend a few minutes just describing how we're working with her and figure out whether what we do might be a fit for you. You know, I love the terminology, Mary Lou, that you gave me, which is that a lot of these initial conversations are AWAF. Are we a fit? So I think that's a really soft, nice way in. And we get a lot of meetings, you know, with that approach inside of existing clients. Yeah, if it's not an existing client, I think it gets at the other thing that you mentioned, which is there needs to be something powerful and compelling. It can't just be about, you know, here's what my, like I see a lot of these emails which say, here's what my company does. It's just all solution. I think some of the more powerful emails, outbound prospecting emails, are set up in a problem solution way, which is something to the effect of, you know, many of the customers I work with are working to solve this particular problem. I you know, I'd love to be able to discuss how we solve that with you and see if we're a fit. So I think the problem solution thing is incredibly important, especially when you're prospecting into an organization that you don't have a relationship with.
Yes, the whole idea of that big idea, which, you know, should be a trigger for the reader to say, yep, that's so true.
Yes.
And relate instead of, you know, the response you don't want is the so what response. So I know you and I had a discussion about the review process of your emails, and you had some really good thoughts about how you go about determining whether an email is ready for prime time, meaning that it could be a template. Tell me some of the things that you do. Is it all gut-based, or is there some wording or the way that the text is placed in the email itself that you look at? Or do you have a Jeremy checklist of what you look at before you let an email go to a template stage?
Yeah, I guess. So definitely. I mean, we're A-B testing constantly. So there's always an A. And people come in with ideas about, you know, salespeople come in with new ideas about what they want to try or what's not, what is or isn't working for them. And that becomes the B. I mean, I try to very rarely say no, because unless I've tried something, I can't know that it's not better. You know, an example of this in a related example is we recently launched Net Promoter Score surveys, which, you know, is designed to help with many things. We want to understand how to improve our product, but also if someone says, you know, they would Net Promoter Scores, would you recommend us to a friend or a colleague? If they say they would recommend, that you can go after them for a referral. So we, you know, we started out with, even then the subject line can have an amazing impact. You know, we started out with one subject line. Actually, we started out by having a link to the survey in the email, and that generated something like a, you know, 2.5% completion rate, which is pretty low. Mm-hmm. We then kept the same subject line and moved the changed it from a link in the survey to actually just being able to click on what the score was. So it was just one click. You didn't have to fill anything out. That doubled the survey response rate to just over 5%. And then we changed the subject line, and that doubled it again to between 10 and 11%. So little changes even to subject lines can have a huge impact. The, you know, the other things I think that are important kind of technically are to write emails as if you're writing them to a friend or a colleague. You know, and that's all kinds of little things. It's like, it's what you put in the subject line. You know, we used to have first name in the subject line, but we stopped doing that because people, you know, people identify that as spam right away. And it's not something, you know, if I sent you an email, I wouldn't say Mary Lou, comma, you know, I would just put the subject in the subject. Mm-hmm. So my big test is whether it's a conversational sort of thing that you would write to a friend or a colleague. The body of the email, right? I mean, you see these marketing emails that say we this and we that. But the same thing, if I were writing an email to you, I wouldn't use the royal we, I would say I. So I think that's a big part of it. And then, you know, if I were writing an email to you, I wouldn't use any HTML formatting, you know, very limited, if not non-existent use of bold or different fonts or caps or colors, right? I mean, the mm-hmm. more plain text the email it is, the better. And the shorter, the better, right? I mean, all these things just very practically. My governing principle is it doesn't go out if it doesn't feel authentic and conversational, as if I were sending it to, you know, to one person I cared about.
Right. And I use the kind of rule, like, it's as if I'm sending it from my cell phone, where, you know, you're going to be briefer, you're going to be to the point, you're not going to be worried about graphics per se, but you have a point that you want to get across, or you want to be able to leave word with someone. And then, you know, that's essentially my rule. Other than if it's really, really cold and I don't know the person, then I'm trying to think about the things that would matter to them. It's always about that, what's in it for them. And we say that all the time, but you really need to think about that, because as Jeremy said, it's not we, it's not us, it's them, it's you, it's the person that you're trying to have this conversation with, in order to be able to share with them something of value.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that perspective of value is so important, which is, you know, I forget, many, you know, sales experts have said this, which is, you know, it's not that you're selling something to somebody, it's that you're giving them the opportunity to buy. And I'll add on your pieces. They're giving them the opportunity to buy if it's a fit. If it's not a fit, you know, I think especially companies that thrive on renewable revenue, which is more and more companies these days. I mean, acquiring a customer who's going to non-renew is not worth it. And certainly acquiring a customer who's going to non-renew and then become a detractor, going to have a negative view of your service and, you know, post negative reviews or tell their friends, that's not worth it. So you really only want customers who are going to get value from you.
Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of your role. Now, you mentioned early on that there's on the back of your badge, it says that you're to make your team happy.
Right.
So what I'm very curious. So what is there a process for that, or how do you measure happiness in your organization now?
Yeah, so we do, like many organizations do, we do an annual employee survey, a pulse check, if you will. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's run by our HR and talent development folks. You know, the good thing about the survey is, in a way, it tells me, you know, precisely what I need to do and the qualitative feedback. What appears to be what people seem to want is a few things. I mean, the one thing that everybody asks for, that all sales professionals ask for, is of course more money. You have a cost of sale to maintain, you have a gross margin you need to maintain. So it's not like you can just wave a magic wand and pay everybody more money. I mean, I'd love to do that, but obviously there's practicalities. I think what you can do is give people much more control over their earning power, right? So, you know, helping people with tools and process and that will help them earn more, I think is an empowering piece of that to make them happy. So I think my two goals are very consistent. The other things that I think make salespeople happier are in particular, I think training is one of the things. So and that comes directly out of the feedback as well. So one of the things that I've been focused on is partnering with our HR folks and our training folks in order to bring, you know, better training into the organization or at least more training into the organization. And so that, I think that's another big lever of happiness. So some, you know, between money, which is hard to control, and training, which is relatively easy to control, although effortful, I think I can hopefully accomplish mm-hmm. the goal.
And they're looking for, when they say training, it's not only sales skills, it's also what, product?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, sales training is training for salespeople, I guess is a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is a pretty comprehensive thing, right? I mean, there are definitely sales skills, and things like negotiation and objection handling come up every survey, everywhere I've ever been, as being incredibly important things. But yeah, there definitely is a hunger at all times for more understanding of the product, which is, or things related to the company and the value proposition. Mm-hmm. I think there's always a hunger for more competitive insight, so that they can understand how to position, you know, our products relative to the competition and what's real and what's not. I mean, if you I think you need to be honest with salespeople to tell them where the competition is stronger and where they're not stronger, so that they don't get blindsided when they go into conversations with prospects. And then I think more broadly, salespeople are, you know, are developing leaders like everybody else is. So I'm a big fan of the 4C framework: creativity, communication, collaboration, and critical thinking. So if there's ways to bring those types of skills to salespeople, I think that's key. And I would double click, I think, amongst those things on the communication piece, because it's directly relevant to salespeople's jobs. And the two areas, well, the one area they ask for is verbal communications. They all want to become better listeners and speakers and questioners. Something that they don't bring up as much, but I think is actually quite valuable, is technical writing. Mm-hmm. And particularly technical writing in the context of writing emails. I think that's an art that's underinvested in and incredibly important. You know,
It's something that's not ubiquitous out there, even in training. You know, there's a lot of writing courses that are available through the internet, but not as it relates to the sales message and how to encapsulate that in a persuasive piece of communication.
Yes. Yeah. There is not a lot out there. And it's practice, right? And you need to get feedback. I mean, I think so often, you know, nobody really gets feedback on their writing anymore. And in fact, you know, I've had people interview for, you know, positions who, and we now actually have our candidates draft a prospecting email, to test out what it's going to look like. And I think that's an incredibly important screen that you have people who have 4-year degrees from decent colleges, and even in liberal arts disciplines, whose writing is just absolutely terrible. And you know, if I have the choice of hiring somebody who can write and who can't write, I can easily, there's enough people who can write that I can weed out the ones who can't. So yeah, I think it's an incredibly valuable skill, and it's something that's becoming more and more, I think, a differentiated skill, because from what I can tell, at least, it seems like fewer and like a smaller and smaller percentage of the candidates that I see are able to you know, write something even when they have time that's grammatically correct and free of typos and spelling errors.
As we go through the rest of 2016 now, what are some of the things that you're hoping to achieve, and where do you see that you're going to be spending more of your time versus less with all the things you've shared with us?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few key areas. I mean, I'm certainly going to be focused on accelerating our outbound prospecting activity. You know, even 4 months is just the tip of the iceberg of you know, that transformation. So that's going to stay at the top of my list. As I mentioned, training will also stay really, really high at the top of my list. Sales compensation as another one that's very high on the list. And the last one, which I didn't mention, is just, you know, looking at not just the point of getting a meeting and qualifying a prospect, but what happens as you manage opportunities after you get that initial meeting. I think that's another key piece where process can become very helpful. I think it's less intensive process, especially in the B2B space, for opportunity management, but I think there's still some process there. And it's worth mentioning, right, is that I don't do any of this alone. I couldn't do all that on alone. I've got a great team that I work with, you know, both directly and indirectly that help to accomplish these initiatives.
I was going to say, that's a lot on your plate.
Yeah.
Because most of the folks who are outbound are working on the outreach side of life, which can encompass inbound as well, as we talked about. That's quite a bit right there on the plate, especially sounds like you're going to be in testing mode for quite some time with the email engine and everything else that you've got going on. That's quite a bit. So it's good that you have a team.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're one or two, you know, I think getting that outbound prospecting engine going is important. And mm-hmm. I would say the two most important things I've learned doing this, with respect to outbound prospecting, the first one is calendar blocking. There's so much resistance to salespeople. They know it's good for them, but they just don't want to do it. You know, I think you need to block your calendar for outbound prospecting. It has to become a habit. And you know, I think a minimum block is 90 minutes. If you go under 90 minutes, you're just not going to get the momentum you need. And really specialize. So like I might do a 90-minute block for email and then a separate 90-minute block for calls, so I'm not going back and forth. So, you know, do those blocks, respect them, do them every day, try to do them at the same time to maintain consistency, have a rhythm. Have a rhythm to it. The other, so I said two things. So one was the calendar blocks. The second most important thing is the power of the phone call. Thus far, you know, we talked a lot about optimizing email, but far and away, we get more meetings and more sales ultimately as the result of dialing. You know, you'll get an email response here and there, but I'd say we probably get, you know, at least 80%, I would say roughly 80% of our meetings via phone calls. So don't get lazy, you know, don't just rely on email. Email is becoming less and less effective no matter how well you optimize it. The phone is the key to success.
Right. And I think that was one of the unfortunate results of people who read predictable revenue, was that they thought the email engine would replace the need to have the conversation via telephone. But I like what you've done, though, in that you warm up that chill a little bit with the email engine, and then you place the calls embedded in the sequence, but further in. Is that correct?
Yeah. And we've had lots of tests and lots of arguments all the time about, do you call first? Do you email first? And what we've actually settled on is the cadence begins with an email in the morning and then a call in the afternoon that falls on the email. So we do that kind of 1-2 punch of email, then call. And, you know, the call often says, something like, I don't know if you saw the email I sent you earlier today. And sometimes they've seen it, sometimes they haven't. And either way, that's okay. But I think that 1-2 punch works really, really well. You know, as we talked about earlier, there's no one right answer all the time. So, you know, it could be if you talk to me 6 months from now, that's not working anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think the one thing that mathematically that's going to work, yeah, is the email warms up the chill, mm-hmm. as you said, and then you got to know what your connect rate is, right? So if your connect to a live human being rate is 20%, then you got to have at least 5 calls. If your connect to a human being rate is 10%, then you got to do at least 10 calls, right? So that's important. And I'll just add, just in case people are worried, you might be doing all those calls, but you're not leaving voicemails all the time. So, you know, we only leave one voicemail at the beginning and one voicemail at the end. All the middle calls are all just calls, no voicemail.
Yeah, what we call dials. They're just dials.
Yep.
Right.
And you can also spread them out, right? So it's mm-hmm. not like you're going to call them 5 times in a week. You can spread that out over 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 6 months, whatever is the appropriate for your prospects.
Right, whatever the sequence is. The other thing that we've discovered is this block time that you spoke about is when you're first starting out, you don't really know what time of day your particular buyer is going to be sitting in that office. So you may have a little roving target for a while of block time. As an example, we had a client who did block time from 8 to 10 a.m., and we did a test where we moved it to 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. They had their connect ratio go up quite significantly. So not only do you want to put things in blocks, and there's a lot of studies about, especially on the phone side, you get better and better the more dials you do. The more conversations you have, you just get better. So don't think that you can break that up, because it doesn't work that way. And the other thing is, initially, you may need to rove the time a bit so that you can see what is best for the particular buyer who you're calling on. And if you have two different buyers, they may have two different block times that you're going to be working on. So that's another thing to think about as you're setting up these calling programs. But they're very important. And the other thing I want, if you didn't hear this, when Jeremy said, is that emails went out in the morning, and then a phone call was placed in the afternoon. That's called intraday. Within the same day, there were two touches. A lot of you guys like to spread out the touches, but obviously there are some nuances that you'll want to test. And intraday is not a bad thing.
Yeah, really important. And not in, even multiple calls in the day. So we have some cadences that have a morning call and an afternoon call. Mm-hmm. You just, whatever you can do to try to get people.
Right, because you have the bullseye of influencers, and you may not target the actual buyer in your calling program. You may target around the buyer if you have that type of sequence. So it's perfectly fine to call in and around the buyer within intraday calling. And I have a lot of clients who are doing that as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to add for our listeners who are thinking, wow?
Well, yeah, it was a lot of information. I mean, I guess I'll sort of restate that kind of key thing that I just said, which is make sure you block time on your calendar every day consistently for prospecting, and make sure you're not afraid to use the phone, because that's going to be your best tool for getting to prospects. If you take nothing else away from, the conversation we just had, that's what you got to take away. That's the key.
Yeah, the phone is still working, and I always tell people that one phone call is 15 emails. You know, if you look at that math, you're going to be spending less time if you can reach the person. You're not always going to be able to do that. So your emails are your backup. They're your backup team to be able to get the message, to warm up that chill, to be able to give them some value that they can download, look at, view, listen to, whatever it is, until you can get a hold of them and continue that conversation.
Yep, brilliant.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.